You better rock it.
We're going to do it together.
With when?
Go to the down bay.
They haven't contacted you yet? It's about our applying by now. With
okay.
all of our frontline staff.
Okay.
You'll need to be able to call.
Are we live?
Are we live?
Hello and welcome to the March 26, 2024 Agricultural Advisory Committee of Alameda County. My name is Carl Wente, your chair. First thing we'll do is call to order. So done. Roll call.
Chair Wente.
Here.
Vice Chair Godwin.
Here.
Member Anderson. Perfect. Member Anderson. Okay, perfect. I'll speak more loudly. Member B. Miller.
Here.
Member Campos.
Here.
Member Farhad.
Yes.
Member Frederick.
Call me, excuse absence. I apologize.
Oh, okay. Member Hoppus?
Yep.
Member Cotman? Member Maines?
Here.
Member Moore?
Yep.
Member Norton?
Here.
Member Quigley?
Here.
Member Roberts?
Here.
Member Sweet Daryl?
Call me, excused.
Okay. And Member Sweet Karen?
Said she'd be here.
Okay. And Member White?
Called it me excused.
And then ex officio members, we have Sheila Carey and Manfo, not yet. Elka, not yet. And Kathy Woods, not yet. So we have a quorum.
We have a quorum. Thank you. Item number three, approval of the minutes. And as some people figured out, may or may not know, the PDF attachment that went out didn't have the direct links to the deeper level attachments, and you had to get into the CDA website to get those attached links. So hopefully everyone was able to get to the documents as need be and have a chance to review the minutes of February 27, 2024.
You might have had the wrong attachment when I went in. It looked like it was the Trails attachment. So I was not able to see them.
Interesting. Was there other people able to see the minutes when they traced it in?
I wasn't able.
Let's just push this one until the next meeting and address as we get through to make sure that we have the relevant information to review it. That's interesting. One time I was, another time blocked. There are a few little technological hiccups in this one. So we're going to push in that one. Next item is the open forum. Any member of the public may address the committee on a matter not on the regular agenda. No discussion or action may be taken on these. We ask for a 2-minute timeline. And open up the public forum to those that are here. Mr. Schneider had something to say originally, but he's going to address that in item number 8 because it related to the general plan of the city of Livermore. He's not looking up, does not, that in case, doesn't want to take advantage of the open forum. Anybody online?
We have no speakers online.
Closing the public forum. Opening the executive committee update and with some. May I be a host to share as well? So I can talk about it.
Can you make Carl a host? Or a co-host?
Well, it wasn't. It's kept trying to now it is allowing. Thank you. The share on the screen, if I'm a visual person, I know what we do, the ECAP purpose and scope, the goals and policies in the East County Area Plan are intended to inform decision makers of small public programs agencies and those doing business in the county of the county's position on land related uses and to provide guidance for day-to-day decision making. So foundational of ECAP as amended by Measure D 2000, as amended by Measure D 2022, This one of 2000, the purposes of this initiative are to preserve and enhance agriculture and agricultural lands and protect the natural qualities, wildlife, habitats, and watersheds, beautiful open spaces of ALCO. And it goes on. We are to be a technical advisory panel of experts to advise Board of Foods on public agencies on matters involving the economic enhancement of agriculture and environmental conservation on applicable agricultural lands, and implement the requirement to convene this group. Technical representatives for our fields and advocates for economically and economically viable agriculture and open space in Alameda County. We'll have demonstrate our expertise in our field. Purpose, powers, and duties. I'm not going to read through these verbatim as they go, but I do every month at least go through and read and want to be held accountable, and this group to be held accountable for how we're doing across that, advising, working with, being part of the community to drive forward agriculture and the preservation of agricultural lands, open space, the likes. The charter, the reason why, is help us set an agenda, help us keep flowing. We want to be a high-functioning committee in service and purpose, powers, and duties. We have committee structures in support of, and we have meetings that are informative and they flow, and you don't have a chair that packs too much in the agenda, so we have to rush through every time, as has been known to happen, hypothetically. Record reflects an answer here. Goals and strategies, efficient meetings, and showing up and reporting out, right? Going to the TNP and reporting out. I forget what agenda item it was that went to the planning commission and it was something to do. And I said, well, has the AAC have something to say on this, right? Because it got into our field. That's a show of respect, comes back, and then we want to be efficient in terms of moving things along as we go. And then subcommittees want to make sure we're not just convening for no purpose, but moving in a good direction and the meeting cadence we're happening. This slide I haven't changed in a long time, and God we trust, everyone else come with data, and the data has a crop report that gives us some dollars across it. Crop report is imperfect because of equine, imperfect because of self-reporting, but it is something. It shows the grapes, and then rangeland cattle, and then hemp is really what it is, and hemp only comes on recently. So really, we're a two-crop pony by the data shown here. And then we have ongoing discussions about how else you measure success beyond just the crop report. And that is the last in that deck. And I'm going to pull up another deck real quick. Same deck up to this point, and then this has been shared previously, of the committee structure. That's just a snip right out of trying to say, okay, here's how we have a setup structure. Charter is behind that. And then the next, this was shared. These were the goals that we laid out at the offsite at the beginning of the year, broken into two groups. First, the goals of that committee. Here's what we're looking at. And then the other goals that people came in and said, even though this wasn't all your goals, or if it was worded differently, it might even get up there. Here are the things we want. So this was shared out previously, right? Head nods. So I'm not seeing it for the first time, but I just think about keeping this in front of us. Are we moving the ball forward at an appropriate pace that we're proud of? Are we doing the right things? Are we not? How do we keep steering the ship? Then all the various other subcommittees. I posted this here just so you know, I did my darndest to transcribe appropriately, and I am a fallible human. And so the other ones. And then this was some of the follow-ups of the discussions for TNP that we had aligned towards of how we wanna, what we wanna go. Solar policy, the EIR, where's the stand, the TBC amendments, and then TBC, I said, I believe they had said there, said, hey, we're formally, like, we'd love to help pay for an EIR consultant moving forward. Talk about the affordable housing and really, farm worker housing and what that means, the needs assessment of 25 grand to move that forward. The Baker-Tilly report of how we move things forward. Committee versus commission. Some people have a strong point of view. Some people said, yeah, it doesn't matter. Membership, that status of the bylaws. Karen, good to have you here. And I was a little taken aback at the TNP of, I thought those were in front of the general powers that be, and they weren't moving up the desk of review, and it's just getting some simple updates there. So people are showing up, we can move them through, so we have a better protocol. And then I have asked Sean Wilson officially, haven't followed up for this one, to come in as a representative of D1 Supervisor's Office and taking a lead role on some of the rural roads committees or rural roads meetings that are convened, so we can address this committee, because that's a theme that's been coming up. So that concludes the update of the executive committee. But before we close this item, anybody else on the executive committee likes to add any color commentary, have anything to say there? Hearing none, in the name of good order, even though it's not an action item potential, we open to the public forum on this item. Anybody online?
No.
Close. 5. Moving 6, presentation on the changes to the farming rights ordinance to support the existing industrial hemp. Director Lopez, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Albert Lopez, plan director. Good to see you all. I haven't seen you in quite a while. And this item is in support of our industrial hemp industry. There are at least one grower that we know in the county currently in operations, and this ordinance is an attempt to be able to codify certain things that will allow them to flourish and to grow into a long-term producer in Alameda County. So I don't have a PowerPoint for this. I do have attached to your packet, there's an ordinance. I was going to speak to that really. This item is to amend our county code in 2 specific places. One of them is the definition of agricultural operation, which is in chapter 6.28010. And there's only one small edit to that, which you will see in the packet, which is to include the word hemp in the definition of an agricultural operation. And this, of course, is to remove any doubt that that is something that the county determines to be a bona fide agricultural operation. And that, again, also provides protection within the rights to farm ordinance. As you'll see in the staff report, is a small blurb about the responsibilities of the Ag Advisory Committee for the right to farm ordinance related to mediation, if someone was to ask for that. As far as I know, there's been a couple instances where the committee's been asked to mediate 2 conflicting parties as per the right to farm ordinance. And I'm not here to talk about that so much, but just to note that, you know, that there is that provision in the code, if you weren't aware of that. And then the other part of the ordinance that we're changing is in the ag zone, in the agricultural A zone, under permitted uses, to identify hemp processing on parcels over 100 acres. So that will be a new permitted use in the zoning code. Chapter 17 is the zoning code. And then a small edit under accessory uses that would allow administrative office and maintenance buildings when they're accessory to a principal use permitted by the above section, which is permitted uses. So essentially what it does is allow, if you do have a agricultural operation, including hemp, that you can have a small maintenance building or office to support that facility that also has a accessory use. So you don't essentially, I guess the bottom line is there's no discretionary permits needed for industrial hemp. You can grow without a permit, and you're allowed certain accessory uses as part of that. And of course, that is for only parcels over 800 acres. And that's it in terms of the ordinance itself. I did also attach a copy of the Farming Rights Ordinance, Chapter 6.28, and then Chapter 17, the A zone, which I'm sure that many of you are very familiar with it. And that's Chapter 17.06, I believe. Yeah. So that's it. That's the idea is that with your blessing, that this will have to go to the Planning Commission, because if we are changing Chapter 17 as a zoning code amendment, it has to go to the Planning Commission, and then the Transportation and Planning Committee of the board, and then to the full board to make these changes and make them part of the county code. So with that, I'll wrap up and take any questions that committee may have.
Perfect. Let's do a show of hands instead of around the room by those that want to have something to say. Diana, I saw you go first. Tracy, Chuck. Go ahead, Diana.
So I had a couple of questions.
The first is this for hemp that's going to be in greenhouses as well? Is that like the same sort of consideration, or is there going to be a FAR consideration for having greenhouses?
So the A zone does allow a certain square footage for greenhouses. This is not cannabis, so this is considered growing like any other crop that we would allow. If somebody wants to grow in greenhouses, they can do that. They can also do an open grow, which I believe is what we have existing.
And then I guess my other question was for the amendment to the zoning and permitted uses, why is it going to be its own line item versus kind of within section B with the other agricultural allowances?
Which section are you referring to?
So you're adding a section L. And then earlier up section B has allowances for other grow operations. Is this specifically for processing of them? Just growing of them?
Yes, that is correct. And the reason why it's L, it just happened to be the next letter, but under permitted uses, it seemed to be there was no other permitted use where we could just sort of tack it on. So that's why it's its own separate line item.
And so that processing plant, that's why I guess that kind of answers the later question of why it's being paired with O for the allowing an administrative office. So it's going to be the actual processing of the building that we're talking about, not just hemp itself.
So an agricultural operation, you're allowed a certain permitted uses, certain floor area allowance. But there's also, you can't just open up an office building, for example, in the A zone. So this is, as an accessory use, it's allowing you to do some sort of either office or maintenance yard, it looks like, to be able to support the facility. So we wanted to make sure that that's a explicitly permitted use and not something that you might have to go through kind of a discretionary permit for or any other kind of permit that the county may issue. You're still gonna need a building permit, of course, but there's no planning permit per se.
Thank you. I'm with Visit Tri-Valley. Albert, a couple questions. I was very familiar with more of the cannabis side of things, so I just wanted to ask on hemp, if it's an open grow, does that mean that they grow hemp to the full boundary of the parcel? That's my first question.
Mm-hmm.
And then does hemp have a similar drift effect that cannabis does that can sometimes taint vineyards?
So I don't know the answer to your second question about the drift effect.
Sorry.
In terms of the first part, the full boundary of the parcel, I mean, we would allow hemp to be grown just like any other crop. So I think that that's going to be...
Except for cannabis, I assume that has probably setbacks and stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
I can't remember all the setbacks right now for cannabis, but yeah, I mean, that's heavily regulated for growing cannabis. But we don't have any grows for cannabis right now in the county. In terms of for hemp, yeah, it would be whatever the standard operating procedure, I guess, for growing that crop.
Maybe I could ask our resident wine expert at the table.
I was going to pass to Norton, right, in terms of the Wine Institute and various other organizations from a wine standpoint have said we don't want sort of indoor-grown cannabis and the terpenes associated with it coming into the crop, because you can... Crops that are grown next to a freeway will smell a little different than are grown out in there, smell a little different than next to a eucalyptus tree in those oils. They're gas exchange systems all year long. So I know if you can smell the terpenes from the product, from the crop, it'll show up in the grape. Now I'm out of my league with hemp, and I'd love to turn it over to Mr. Lawrence for any insight.
Yeah, absolutely. To the question of whether it affects vineyards, that is something I have heard about, but factually, I don't know whether that's the case or not, but I have heard about the case of eucalyptus or other crops having this effect, so it doesn't sound unreasonable that could be the case.
Thank you. I just know for cannabis, it can be quite serious, so I just didn't know, I know they're not the same crop, but... get to the same results sometimes.
But the odor issues are very similar.
The odor?
The odor from the hemp smelled very much like cannabis, and it drifts into the neighborhoods or across.
Thank you. Those were my two questions. Thank you.
Ms. Moore?
A little bit naive on the difference in hemp and pot or cannabis. So I'm just wondering if hemp is not related to cannabis, why do we have to have special rules for hemp? Why would it be just like any other crop? Somebody's planting corn, beans, whatever. Are these folks that are growing or raising the hemp, are they subject to an SDR, or is it something like, I don't know enough about it, but I'm wondering why special set of rules for hemp.
Sure.
It's not cannabis.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I think that it's a relatively new crop, at least for us, as a regulatory body. And there was some concern about the lack of mention of hemp in our code. For the most part, in the entire county, is not really anything that speaks to it. So I think that was one of the reasons why that this zoning ordinance change was requested. Also, it does allow over 100 acres. So I think that the desire there was to make sure that any operation was going to be on a big enough parcel so that it potentially wouldn't impact adjacent uses. I think for the most part, though, it's just because it was a new crop and there was maybe some question mark about the difference between cannabis and hemp, and he wanted to make sure that our zoning code and the right to farm ordinance was clear that this was a permitted crop.
Yeah, I'm just kind of confused why we have enough to go through permitted if it's not cannabis, and we regulate cannabis. We have permits only so many of them given, and but hemp, to me, the one I'm reading appears to be a regular crop. So what would be the next crop somebody would come into the community with? Are we going to change the ordinance again and put that in there? Because we don't see it in the community as well that we do. I don't like the fact that we single out a particular crop in when it should be considered as any other crop somebody wants to plant, other than cannabis, because of a lot of reasons, but I don't know why that's going down this road.
When was the last time it was updated?
The agricultural operation definition? I know that there's been some definition changes, but this particular definition, I don't think it's changing.
And I don't know exactly. I've seen copies from like 1982 or what, but I don't know if they've been updated. But there's nothing in the current ordinance that prohibits the growing of hemp in Alameda County or anywhere. So as it stands and as written, hemp is a legal crop federally. So there's nothing that would prohibit any operations of hemp within Alameda County as it's written. We do have one large grower and then one very small grower currently. We've had three or four or five, maybe I think it's the maximum number of growers we had. It just hasn't turned out the cash cow that they thought it would be. So currently we have one small grower and one quite large grower.
Understood. Thank you. So let's sit with hands, please, so I can help have half a chance. Mr. Bimel.
Another question. Who's driving these changes? Who's requesting this stuff?
So the one grower that that Kathy was just mentioning, Garden of Eden, requested these changes. And there's a few other things that we're working on with Garden of Eden. I mean, they're our largest, as you know, both on the retail side as well as on the hemp side.
Ms. Norman.
My understanding is that hemp is currently allowed as an allowed use in the county. And by adding it to the permitted uses, adding it to the definitions of agricultural operation is an attempt to codify that so that there's no confusion between hemp and cannabis. Does that sound correct?
Yes, definitely. So, and then just following up, and I'd take more questions, but hopefully we can also move this along, right? I don't believe viticulture should be in there either, because viticulture is a distinct sub of horticulture. Now, I'd be a fool to say, let's take it out now, right? It's waste time and space. So viticulture has a special place there. It doesn't need to. Hemp, I think it has more reason to because of the lack of clarity. You said, you know, the difference between hemp and weed and pot and dope. Like, it is making it clear. This is growing fiber, right? If it's growing fiber, it's a clear subset of viticulture, clear subset of horticulture. Hell, they're all subsets of agriculture, like cultivation. So it doesn't matter much to me. Is the thing about it. Why? Like, I'm already special. Let's make hemp special and move on. That's going to be my take on this one. And then from the processing operation on 100 acres, I'm very much in support of that, because most crops need some semblance of processing to go to market, and processing should be closer to where it's grown because the world's a better place that way. My simple bias. Anybody else have anything to say? Or I'd love to entertain a motion on this one.
I think it's if it helps a farmer survive in today's environment and keeps farms around.
In line with our mission, purpose, powers, and duties of supporting the economic ecosystem. So one more reason I'd love to entertain a motion.
I'm not ready to make a motion. I have a definition question, because I always believed that cannabis had two basic levels of it. There's hemp and there's marijuana. And the differences we're talking about is really between marijuana and hemp, and they're both cannabis.
I'm out of my league. Sorry if I use the wrong words.
Well, if it's helpful, Chuck, I believe that the state has essentially stopped using the term marijuana and uses the term cannabis in place. So it's quite confusing. Logically, you're absolutely correct, yes. I believe, but the state has adopted the term cannabis to mean the plant and the THC.
Okay. Anybody else? No comments? Does anybody like to end?
I have one more comment. Yep. Just in terms of the staff report, there was questions of discussion of whether there should be limitations. I can't find it. But in terms of within the South Lake Valley,
it's on the second page, at the end of the second page.
Okay. Yeah. Or consideration on smaller parcels, whether we wanted to discuss that at all before we made a motion.
Can you put it into better words if I'm looking at this one?
Yeah.
It brings up more, right? This amendment is for limiting to large scale activities in the more remote part of the county, right, to the 100 acre piece. County may want to consider prohibiting hemp operations in South Valley area plan, a sub combining district cultivated ag, which has been the case for cannabis, as there are parcels more than 100 located. So that one, a very fair point of the discussion to me that the committee may want to consider. We can make a recommendation there.
I can say that going back a number of years, back to Scott Haggerty days, that when we were developing all of our ordinances related to cannabis, that there was a desire to exclude them in South Livermore. I think the idea of the drift factor really wasn't as prominent then. But if the committee wanted to make a recommendation that we explore that and sort of push it up the food chain to the planning commission and the board, we'd be happy to do that. And specifically mention South Livermore potentially being an area where we wouldn't want to permit this particular land use type.
This TBC is in a better place to sort of fundamentally, and I'm not putting you on the spot to have that point of view, because I know they've said, and I don't know, right? Just growing fiber hemp, what does it smell like versus a, but again, if you're next to the freeway or smoke taint, right, it becomes the same thing of these molecules of getting in, and then why is that smell that way? And you're looking for the beauty of those grapes. So, but I'm not sure we're ready to take that full fundamental action, because there's, you know, but I'd be open to it as well.
But doesn't that require him to have a site development review? And if we take that kind of action, which now you're saying that this particular area is not conducive to growing hemp because of grapes or something, I mean, then you'd have to go into a permitting process to grow hemp. Is that correct?
It would be more of a prohibition in the South Livermore Valley Area Plan, which is a distinct area. So if you're in that plan area, then you would not be able to use this provision of the zoning code for hemp.
Right, but, and there's other areas in the county that do grow grapes besides South Livermore. Nowhere near the magnitude, but there are some folks that are growing grapes in other areas. So then it comes down to, then are we looking at, if it has an impact on existing farming, then should it require a review before it's, I'm just wondering.
Finish statement, Tracy.
No,
clarify. No, Chuck, I'd just like to comment that, this idea of the taint is we're referring to it as a negative idea, but I believe there would be some possibility that it could be a positive commercial development as well, that maybe somebody might actually seek to have that occur.
I don't doubt, maybe, probably, and if someone comes in to try to throw in 100 acres of hemp in an industrial operation within the South Valley Area Plan, I'm pretty sure the well-funded TVC would sort of go gonzo on that as it flows through, right? So I'm not about a priori prohibiting things, right? We're supporting agriculture and having it go. Like someone comes in, it shows, like, let it go. Do it on the east side. The windmills are pointing that way because it's going that way, and it goes, and we have another 100 acres of hemp. We've actually increased the agricultural economy, which is what we're supposed to do. So I'm in the South Valley Plan. I care deeply, as anybody in this room, I bet, about the success of the South Valley Area Plan. And I'm saying what I'm saying here to expedite it, to make a ruling, have a point of view from this committee, hemp added to the list. It doesn't matter fundamentally because it's already there. And then 100 acres for the processing, let it go. Now, in South Valley Area Plan, me, I'm not willing to say let's nix it because I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze right now. Yes, sir.
Well, I don't know if we're regulating things either, believe me. But on the other hand, if it's a new crop and fairly new to the county and we're unsure what the impact would be on grape growers or other crops, shouldn't we do maybe for the first 5 years as a test or something, as a site development review, just to make sure before somebody comes in and plants 100 acres next door to you, and all of a sudden you have a different flavor in your grape? I might like it, but you know.
That was a whole lot of regulation for someone that doesn't like regulation, and one more step in the process. We could make that recommendation. I don't support it.
Carl.
Yes.
Currently, our small hemp grower is in the South Valley area. So and he's definitely not 100 acres, so this may not affect him, but currently there is no permitting for growing hemp. They have to register with the agriculture department because they're special, and then we do special sampling on them to make sure that they are hemp and not cannabis. But beyond that, there's no special regulations in Alameda County. Other counties do have put in ordinances to prohibit all growing of hemp. But right now, they don't have to do anything special through planning or through agriculture, other than registering with us to ensure the varieties are grown. But you know, you're going to start putting in regulations that's going to hurt at least one potential grower that we already have.
Mr. Tracy.
Question: the other larger grower that you have, how long have they been growing? Do you know?
When did hemp become legal?
Has it been more than 5 years?
Five or 6 years. They've both been in operation about our big grow and our small grow, and a couple others have all been in operation about the same amount of time. 5 years, maybe?
Chuck, I think that might answer our question right now. We haven't heard anybody say anything other than that. Can I make a motion, Chair? I would separate the two and make a motion to approve adding hemp to the description as so proposed by the county staff.
Ordinance and the farm to rights.
And the what?
And the farm to rights.
Thank you.
The right to farm.
But not what about hemp processing on parcels?
Well, the zoning part. Yes.
There were two significant underlying sections.
You're supporting the staff report, the recommendation.
Is that the case? Supporting the staff recommendation,
yes,
not having anything
staff.
To say on South Valley, which was an addendum one.
Yes.
And in the process, thinking of a lot of other crops that are as a size, correct?
Not for beef.
Yeah.
Not so there's
for vineyards for
wineries are permitted by right. Wineries are special, right? I had a bias towards I don't want crops to be special, but that's what we do. So wineries are there and the likes, but getting into processing is a thing because one, there's a limit on the meat processing, there's a limit on cheese, milk, other, like there's a certain amount where it's not crystal clear. But so laying it out doesn't hurt. Karen, there's a motion on the table, by the way. The motion is to support the staff recommendation without addressing anything specific for South Valley Area Plan at this point.
And I will second that as long as I can make a comment that I think in these types of discussions, this crop or any other crop, I think it's important to recognize that we have to trust producers to grow ethically, so to speak, but also a policy that California Farm Bureau has is that they, which is also a downfall and not as a weakness of Farm Bureau, is that they try not to have crops combating one another in rules and legislation and so on. And so I think as a body, we're supporting all of agriculture, trust that the producers and the county and other stakeholders work with us for that goal of sustainable agriculture. And that I trust that the right to farm ordinance and its provisions for conflict mediation will deal with conflicts should they arise.
Well said. We have a motion and a second. Is that motion and second clear mm-hmm. to you? Is it clear to this group? Open to this group for comments on the motion and second.
Yeah, I have a question, Albert. I don't understand why processing isn't being allowed on parcels less than 100 acres. Are there noises or increased odor, or what's the reason for that?
I don't necessarily think that allowing hemp operations on smaller parcels would be a bad thing. So I think that was just mostly geared towards what we have now, what we see coming in the future, which is on larger parcels, just given that type of crop that it is. But you know, we don't have a ton of experience with it necessarily in the county, at least, you know, the planning department. I think Kathy's shop probably sees it more than we do.
Okay.
But I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to happen on smaller parcels. But then at that point you might be more in a neighborhood, for example, as opposed to, you know, way out in,
sure,
in a very secluded area or a very low population area. So
okay. So follow up, does a wine grower have a perspective on particular impacts from processing, say on a 20 acre parcel, hemp processing?
Do the wine growers care about the size of the parcel, the processing crop, of which there's very little in our area?
Yeah.
Not much. We're trying to survive ourselves and the right. Like, someone comes in, I'm biased towards, I wouldn't limit it to hundreds. But that also gets a slippery or slope into wine country and the likes, and this incremental step forward and the people pushing for it, I don't hear saying want it down to 20. I don't believe in self-limiting that acre size either, but Measure D handed us some cards and we have some cards. There's already parcel sizes there. So I agree with you in principle. It's not what was here in front of us. We can make an added recommendation, but I'm not sure that serves the greater process fundamentally.
Okay, and Jack, do you know of impacts from processing that would be more significant if they were on a smaller parcel?
The processing itself, I don't believe so. I could see some reason for keeping it on large acreage, but I also don't necessarily see it as being wrong for being on smaller acreage.
Okay, so.
And I concur with what Carl said. So
as it's written, processing is just allowed on 100 acres or larger. Is that correct?
Yes, so that's a numerical standard in the zoning code. So right. If somebody wanted to do processing of less than 100 acres, they need a variance for that.
Okay.
So it's kind of weird. We don't usually, it's not a use variance, it's more of a parcel standard.
Right.
Anything else in this? Open to the public? Public? Public online?
No online speakers.
With that, say aye and raise your hand if you are in support of. Aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Diana is opposed. Mr. Hoppies is opposed. Record reflects pass. I do that okay?
Yeah. Did you get the count?
Yeah.
Ms. Lopez, anything else? Close this item.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Presentation. Where are we? We'll make sure we're right. No, item number 7. Presentation on free groundwater technical assistance for small farmers and other underrepresented groups in what is SGMA?
Sigma. Sustainable groundwater management.
Thank you, Savannah. So thanks to Karen pushing it forward. I said this at the GPAC of the city of Livermore, and I said it to Mr. Schneider back there, is if we aren't speaking the same language with each other, we're inherently not communicating and functioning well. So it's always working to define the acronyms to educate people as it goes. So we can all be part of it. I should have known that one anyway. So that floor is yours.
Awesome. Thank you. So my name is Mary Subiger. I am an environmental planner at DUDEC, which is a California-based environmental consulting firm. And we are currently on contract with the California Department of Water Resources to provide groundwater technical assistance to small farmers, underrepresented communities, and tribes in California. So I am here today to talk about the program, and my supervisor is joining online, Jane Gray. She is the project manager for this program. I'm not sure if she can say hello because the webinar privileges on there.
I just allowed her to speak. Jane, if you'd like to.
Hi there. Can everybody hear me?
Yes,
yeah.
We can hear you.
Thanks. So I'm not Matt Nathalie. I'm Jane Gray. With DUDEC, been working with the Department of Water Resources since 2021 on this program for both federally and non-federally recognized tribes, underrepresented communities, and small farmers under the Department of Water Resources. Next slide.
Thanks.
I'll give a bit of program background. Next slide. So the program really grew out of the acknowledgement by California Department of Water Resources, DWR, that in the process of working on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, Groundwater Sustainability Agency Formation, and Groundwater Sustainability Planning, there was a real need to ensure that all communities were being represented and that AB 685, Human Right to Water legislation, was being incorporated into sustainable groundwater management overall. And again, SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, was passed in 2014. We are 10 years in on this process and a lot more to come until most basins hopefully receive their sustainability point in 2042. Next slide, please. So the program as conceived in 2021, again, was based on the understanding that more than 1 million Californians still lacks clean, safe, affordable drinking water, and that most of those Californians are in rural communities, underserved and low income communities, as well as community of color. And that California has more Native American people than any other state in the United States. Similarly, those tribal entities, both federally and non-federally recognized tribes, have access to both clean, affordable drinking water and also ability to access the groundwater resources that are under their land. Next slide, please. So the purpose of the program, next slide. Thanks. Purpose of the program is to A, communicate with these folks, tribes, underrepresented communities, and small farmers. We do that by various means and methods. We'll get to that later on in the presentation. Once we have communicated with these folks, sat down in dialogue and conversation with them, understood what their needs, risks, and vulnerabilities are as it relates to water supply and water quality, then discuss options to provide technical assistance to them for really any of those water supply, water quality needs, risks, and vulnerabilities that they have articulated. And then again, because we're working with these folks in sustainable groundwater management areas, communicating with the groundwater sustainability agencies to ensure that there is a tie-in and a discussion connecting these communities with the groundwater sustainability agencies so that folks are then represented through implementation of those groundwater sustainability plans. Next slide, please. Program in brief. Maris, you want to take these next slides?
Sure. And I was just going to add before I move forward. So just as background, Alameda County has four SGMA-regulated sub-basins. East Bay Plain, which extends roughly from San Pablo to slightly south of Hayward, is sort of the entirety of that basin. Niles Cove is in the Fremont area, Livermore Valley, and then there's a tiny portion of the Tracy sub-basin that's actually in Alameda County. So just a background so we know where we're talking about. So this is some history on the program. So in reaching out to agencies, CBOs, CDPs, and communities, and conducting needs assessments and developing heat maps, it became apparent that small farmers were facing similar challenges as tribes and underrepresented communities with regards to compliance with the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And then in 2022, a report was produced by CAP, which is the Community Alliance of Family Farmers, Civic Well, Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, Clean Water Action / Clean Water Fund, and University of California Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources, better known as DCANR. They produced a white paper collectively on the impact of SGMA on small farmers. So it was more or less both of these reasons that we incorporated small farmers into our program shortly thereafter. So this is a little bit more information on that white paper. So this white paper calls for the need or illustrates the need for more coordination and communication between GSAs and small farmers. It emphasizes the need to recognize the Farm Equity Act of 2017 and, quote, call attention to the plight of socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers, including farmers of color who have historically not had equitable access to land and other resources to conduct farming in California. So again, this is why we wanted to include small farmers as an eligible entity for our services. So this white paper again outlined the following challenges that small farmers are particularly vulnerable to. So drought-related impacts, groundwater pumping fees, water allocations, groundwater trading and markets, and land fallowing. So again, DWR, in response to the outcome of the 2021 program, and in concert with this white paper, we have folded small farmers into the program as an eligible entity to receive technical assistance. DWR and UDEC are collaborating with organizations that have trusted relationships with small farmers. So the logos on the right side of the screen are some of the groups we're working with, the Water Foundation, Community Alliance of Family Farmers, and CANR. Next slide, please. So a question we get often when we talk about providing services to small farmers is, how are you defining a small farmer? So first of all, we did want to say that we are taking comments on our current version of the small farmer definition until the end of June. So as we're walking through these slides, if you have any thoughts, please don't hesitate to share them with us. They are very, very helpful. So just as a little bit of background, USDA defines small farmers as an operation with a gross cash farm annual income under $350,000, and this includes commercial and non-commercial farms. Furthermore, USDA and CDFA, California Department of Food and Agriculture, define socially disadvantaged farmers or ranchers as members of socially disadvantaged groups who have been subjected to racial, ethnic, or gender prejudice because of their identity as members of a group without regard to their individual beliefs. So these groups include African Americans, Native American Indians, Alaska Natives, Hispanics, Asian Americans, and Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. USDA further expands on this definition to include historically underserved farmers and ranchers, including beginning, socially disadvantaged veterans, and limited resource farmers. So with all of this in mind, therefore, the purpose of this program and use of funds, DWR defines small farmers as two or more of the following criteria, which we are going to talk through. So the first criteria is limited resource farm households with low farm sales and low household income for 2 years in a row. And low farm sales is defined as direct or indirect gross farm sales less than $350,000. And low household income means less than 85% of the median household's income. So that's the first criteria. The second criteria, again, you have to meet two of the four to qualify as a small farmer for this definition. A ranch or farm of 50 acres or less that's operated by a farmer or rancher who qualifies as a socially disadvantaged beginning or veteran farmer. A farm who has an owner that is socially disadvantaged and subjected to racial, ethnic, or gender prejudice because of their identity as a member of a group without regard to their individual qualities. This includes women-owned farmers and ranchers. And then the fourth criteria is a beginning farmer rancher who has materially and substantially participated in the operation of any farm or ranch for 10 years or less. All operators of the farm or ranch must be beginning farmers or ranchers to qualify under this criteria. A beginning farmer or rancher can also qualify if they've undergone a significant transformation in agricultural processes in the last 10 years and are operating under regenerative agriculture processes, indigenous farming methods, cover crops, agroforestry, permaculture, or any other farming or ranching practice that results in the regeneration of soils and then this is just defining the veteran farmer rancher reference. So a veteran farmer rancher is defined as a person who served the United States Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, or Coast Guard, including the reserve components thereof, and who has been discharged or released therefrom under conditions other than dishonorable. So I apologize, I know it's a lot of words, a lot to think through. It is included in the presentation deck. We also have handouts in the back of the room that have that whole definition on a sheet of paper, as well as the QR code that's on the screen. But if you scan that QR code or email the email address on the screen, sgm_tk@water.ca.gov, you can send your comments on that definition directly to DWR.
I'm just going to interject for a minute. Thanks, Maris, for taking us through that. So we really encourage you to take a look at that definition. And if you do have thoughts, happy to take them today, but it's really more impactful if you draft them and send them in an email so that we have record, DWR has record, and we can respond to those. Go ahead and do that. Feel free to scan that QR code. You should have this presentation in your packet as well.
Awesome. So now we're going to talk a little bit about exactly what services we're providing and how we're conducting outreach and engagement. I'll also add again, there are flyers in the back that our infographics representing the process to actually obtain services and also a list of the specific services we're providing in multiple languages. So feel free to take one or more of those on your way out. So in terms of the communication, outreach, and engagement that we've done to date, we've prepared multilingual materials customized to the needs of tribes, underrepresented communities, and small farmers. We have coordinated with GSAs, cities, counties, resource conservation districts, farm bureaus, ag commissioners' offices, CBOs and CBPs across the entire state of California. At this point, we have to date called every single GSA, every single farm bureau.
What's GSA?
I'm sorry, Groundwater Sustainability Agency.
What's CBO?
Community-based partner and community-based organization.
Thank you.
Sorry. Too fast. And RTD's Resource Conservation District. So today we have called every single GSA in the state, Resource Conservation District, Farm Bureau, Ag Commissioner, and either spoken to them live or left a voicemail. We are giving presentations like this, hosting workshops. We're conducting site visits, needs assessments, and surveys to people who think they might be a good fit for the program. We've also produced graphics, animations, and videos to further engage folks on this program. So a little bit more about specifically the services we are providing. So that picture is of one of our hydrogeologists, Matt Napoli, who's the deputy project manager for this program. He is there looking at, anyway, the services we can provide are groundwater level monitoring, so including instrument installation and training. We can perform aquifer testing to determine long-term yield and supply. We can conduct soil moisture monitoring, open groundwater quality testing and treatment.
And I'm just going to interject again. Thanks, Maris. These are examples of work that we have already done with a number of different small communities, small farmers, and tribes. So this is sort of you can think about it as a list of these are the things but are not limited to sort of list. And we evaluate really on a case-by-case basis, depending on what issues present themselves through the process of those needs assessments. Also the surveys, for example, when we're working with tribal entities, we are not only thinking about the infrastructure itself, we have a whole component within our long form survey that discusses cultural uses of water, community perceptions of water, how water is communicated about at the community level. So we get into not only sort of the infrastructure side, but also really, particularly the tribal side, dialogue around issues of import to that particular population. Similarly, when, working with small farmers or underserved communities, there's just a different relationship that folks have from the perspective of water not only being a commodity. It is a means by which they live, by which their plants live, by everything that they are doing. It's sustaining life. So it's it takes on a different dimension. Sorry, go ahead, Maris.
Thank you. So this is a few more of the services we can provide under this program. So we can also provide analysis of well interference, analysis of existing well conditions using downhole video log and pump testing. We can facilitate well repair and or pump construction. We also, and that includes picking locations for wells, designing and overseeing construction. We can also perform groundwater impact analysis for new or existing wells, analysis of groundwater level decline and reduction in storage, land subsidence, impacts to groundwater dependent ecosystems. So in terms of outcomes from this program, so the first thing we do is we, again, conduct a needs assessment. We summarize the needs, or we look at the needs, risks, and vulnerabilities that a tribe, underrepresented community, and or small farmer experiences. We prepare a summary of the needs assessment and explore potential TA support services.
What's TA?
Technical assistance, sorry. Thank you. Once the site visit needs/needs assessment is conducted, DUDEC prepares a summary of the potential services and solutions, and that summary is provided to the tribe, underrepresented community, or small farmer, as discussed. And the path forward is explored.
So I think what we're really trying to communicate in this slide is that this is a community process. We are working with the community, A, to understand what their needs, risks, and vulnerabilities are. And that goes the same for tribes and small farmers. It is not sort of, we have all the answers. It's really having a conversation, figuring out what the presenting concerns are, understanding sort of systematically what possibly we could work on in a collaborative way in order to either move that community forward, move that small farmer forward or that tribe forward, and then figure out how that community, small farmer or tribe wants to move ahead. And then we think about the solutions that we can provide. So, you know, if we're working in one small community, for example, is consolidation an option? How do people feel about point of use, point of entry systems if there's water quality issues? Does it need to be wellhead treatment? So there's, you know, a range of scenarios, for example, that can be discussed. And we're not, as technical service providers, putting a one size fits all kind of solution out there, but really trying to ascertain what the appetite of the community is, how they want to move forward, and how we can support them in that process. So some of the hardcore outcomes that we have achieved with the folks that we've been working with are preliminary engineering reports and hydrological reports. So these are documents that a tribe or a small community, small farmer can utilize to go to the next stage of funding a particular infrastructure project. We support them through the associated permitting processes. We can provide them groundwater to monitoring and systems opportunities, as well as training. So once we have provided a solution or there's a need for well operation, we can provide both the training on site as well as a manual. We work with a number of different impact analyses that are related to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and the undesirable results. We've worked with groundwater sustainability agencies on, you know, policy discussions around compliance with executive orders, for example. And then again, once we give them a deliverable and they need funding, we have supported on funding through state and federal grants. So whether that is connecting that entity, that small community, small farmer or tribe with USDA or USBR or US EPA funding, or supporting them through that grant process, we want to ultimately get them to a point where they can realize the solution that's being proposed.
And I have to move very quickly through the case studies. There's good information in there, so we can get to discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So case studies, again, we just provided some peer review for Yolo County in their compliance with Executive Order N-722, and that is requiring GSAs, groundwater sustainability agencies, to approve well permits. Next slide, please. So we worked with the city of Tahoma on their water system needs assessment. Really small city with a very small staff. They had absolutely no water storage, which is a big problem, both from the drought perspective as also the fire suppression perspective. So we produced a number of reports. We cited some storage locations, provided them with engineering reports on volumes for flow and maximum daily requirements. We also looked at the feasibility of consolidating with nearby entities, completed a funding matrix to support them to get funding, and then they were approved for DWR, Small Community Drought Relief funding, to construct an additional groundwater well. Next slide, please. Fillmore Irrigation Company, really small irrigation company in Ventura County. They are completely groundwater dependent, don't have any surface water supplies, no importation, and they provide water to agricultural and domestic customers. We've prepared an outline for upgrades and improvements to their system, their distribution system, storage, and replacement of wells, and are also supporting them with questions as things come up when they're evaluating what to do next. Great. Case study of Plantation Mobile Home Park. This is right in downtown Sacramento. It is a mobile home park that was decimated from a fire. It is extremely underserved. It is dependent on one well that is contaminated. And we are working with the City of Sacramento County Department of Water Resources on options for consolidation at this point. That's it.
Thank you so much. Remind as we go around, do the same show of hands as we go. Remind, this is an informational item. Thank you both so much for the presentation as it's flowing through. And then so as we're, this is informational item. We don't need to get too deep into what we think about the laws, what we think about its implementation, the execution, or otherwise. They have some specific feedback on some definitions in there. I'm just hoping to be succinct, but to provide value as it goes. Hands, Karen, Miranda.
My question, ladies, is you don't mention guidance and opportunities for funding sources for some of these infrastructure pieces. Do you have links and so on that kind of help direct people to funding to support these infrastructure changes?
Yeah, so that's part of what we provide. So A, the technical assistance services are free of charge. So if you meet the eligibility requirements of being a small farmer or an underrepresented community, we have a link to that website. In your materials where there's a map and it shows the high priority, medium priority areas in which we're working statewide. Once we find a solution with the community, again, whether that be consolidation or a new well that needs to be drilled, we support on state and federal funding applications. So we provide a funding matrix. We have a conversation about what folks should avail themselves of in terms of the most optimal grants or loans.
Thank you.
Okay, number two. Okay, go ahead.
So you described the definition of commercial and non-commercial, but what do you mean exactly by non-commercial? Because in my mind, that could be anywhere from homesteads to horse barns to even an apartment complex. So.
Yeah, so I think it's, the 50 acres, right? I don't think an apartment complex necessarily is going to be farming 50 acres. So there, and again, this is a draft definition that was crafted by CAF and the Department of Water Resources. DUDEC doesn't have any skin in that game. Essentially, DWR is taking comments on that definition. So if you meet those income and those acreage requirements, along with two other components of that definition, then you qualify. It's going to be very different depending on where you are in the state, if you're growing alfalfa or if you're growing strawberries, right? So we are crafting this definition ultimately, I think, on a region by region basis. There's 58 counties. We can't have 58 different definitions, but agriculture is by and large, a regional sort of adventure in the state of California, in that each hydrologic region has its own irrigated lands program. So there's sense in doing it that way. Each hydrologic region, which is coterminous with regional water quality control board, also helps to define the way agriculture is promulgated in the state. Just as much as climate. So at this point, I do think that DWR is going to land on a more regional definition of what a small farmer is, as opposed to one size fits all, which this definition sort of is. I don't know. Hopefully that answers your question.
Someone said Chuck's. He said Chuck's next.
Chuck. I have a couple just comments and questions. One is, on page 26, you talk about hydrology reports. Are you guys providing water finders for farmers that are struggling finding water? And then when you talk about 50 acres or less, it has to be a pretty high yield crop for a farmer to survive in the Bay Area. So I'm just wondering if you really thought that through with the 50 acre number, because there are not many crops that you do 50 acres and do $350,000. Your mortgage would be outrageous. So, I'm just wondering if that's been thought through as a number to work with in the Bay Area. I'm not sure how other counties and you get out in the boonies with it. It might work. And I wondered if you had an opportunity to rate our county and how we fare, because I was reading through the report where you said that so many people are getting poor quality water. How does our county rate, and if you guys had an opportunity to do that? And then you mentioned something about groundwater pumping fees. Is that something that you're giving us a heads up on that we don't know about yet?
They're all really good questions. Remind me of the first question.
just to back up, I think we are not the Department of Water Resources. So we're DUDEC, we're a water and environmental firm. We are on contract to provide technical assistance services. So we can answer, I think, some of these questions, but just want to make sure that there's a distinction between the Department of Water Resources and the program that we are supporting them on.
Okay, so that's a no on the water binders. on the water pumping fees, are you
so
reading the tea leaves here? Or are you telling?
No. And I think to Jay's point, that's exactly what she was getting at. There are some parts of the state where there are groundwater pumping fees.
Well, we've had them in the past in some parts of our county.
Right, and some groundwater sustainability agencies might be promulgating that. So if there are groundwater sustainability agencies that are going to be charging those pumping fees, that's again, you know, within the groundwater sustainability agency world. That is, you know, not something that DWR is promulgating, and that's not something that we are suggesting through this program.
And we had an opportunity to rate our county. We have, I believe, three different water agencies that manage the water for us on the rural side. That would be Zone 7, ACDWD, which is Alameda County Water District, and then, of course, our Public Works Department. And I was wondering if you had an opportunity to spend time with those folks to find out how our water is working out. I mean, are we one of these 1 million people?
Yeah. So I will say, DWR publishes online. They look at every groundwater basin in the state, and they have a set of criteria, water quality, subsidence, and they provide a rating for every single sub-basin in the state. That actually was a large component of the law that eventually became the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, because sub-basins that were ranked medium, high, or very high are regulated by the Department of Water Resources or by the state under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. So if you go online and you type in your address, you can figure out which groundwater basin you're in, and all the information that DWR has, you know, calculated on your sub-basin is available online. So I'm happy to send you the link.
No, I've seen the link.
Okay.
I was wondering if you guys have had a look at our county. And I was just wondering also, boron is a pretty prominent problem in a lot of areas in our county, particularly for small farmers. And it's a very, very difficult item to get rid of. And, you know, if one or two parts per million, it'll turn your grass one. So are you guys working with anything in the government that would help some of these small folks that spend $50,000 drilling a well, and then it's, you know, at 5% boron? I mean, that's the things that would help small farmers.
Yeah, so we do that water quality testing. So we can certainly support on that. If there is treatment needed for that boron, we can certainly work with a small farmer to understand what that treatment would look like in order to ensure that that MCL, that maximum contaminant limit, isn't, you know, exceeded.
That's enough for me.
I don't know the order, Ms. Quinn.
To follow up on Chuck's questions, other than, I know Zone 7 is one of the GSAs in Alameda County. Are there others?
I believe there are. I'll give you a full list.
ACWD,
Zone 7 is the main one. But let me see if we have a list of all of them. So DWR's list, but I'm happy to.
Yeah, DWR has got a wonderful website, and on wells, I learned a lot from you guys, honestly. And do you work for the chief section of DWR, Arthur Hinojosa, I know what his section is, and I'm guessing you guys might work under his, what section of DWR?
We are working between FAB, which is the financial assistance branch, and SIGMO, which is a sustainable groundwater management office. So okay. Art has, you know, a lot of different programs under him, but our funding is essentially through the financial assistant branch of the Department of Water Resources.
Okay. Because on April 12th, DWR is going to provide a tour of the South Bay Aqueduct again for us. They did one in August. So anybody here that wants to get on that tour, I would encourage them to hop aboard and let me know. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I believe there are hands on this side. Diane.
I may have missed this. This is probably slide one, but what is the life of the program? Is it forever?
No, it's not forever. It's a finite program. And again, just want to sort of emphasize that it's not a grant funded process. It's a really a first come, first serve until 2027. So we have funding. So DUDAC has a specific pot of funding through 2027. And then our collaborators, Civic Well, Water Foundation, CAF, UCANR, you know, UC Cooperative Extension, has also a finite amount of money through 2027. That totals about $17 million.
Anybody else? Let's go with Nan.
Yeah, so glad you asked that question. Because I was wondering how stable the funding is. $17 million is what you've spent so far, or that's the total pot?
No, that's the total pot of funding. And again, okay. it's not project funding. So it's technical assistance funding.
Right. So I have a question. On the flyers, you know, and the title is about tribes and underrepresented communities and small farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a definition? Are you reaching out to communities as well? Because it's not clear.
Yeah, so we started this program with DWR in 2021. And so we've been working with underrepresented communities since 2021. If you go on the website, the URCTA website that DWR has, we created a mapping tool, again, that goes beyond the water code, disadvantaged community, severely disadvantaged community, economically disadvantaged area. Rubric expands that out. Again, we're only working in SIGMA regulated basins, but we have been providing services to about 12 to 15 different underrepresented communities. I selected just those case studies because we can go through a lot. And we are working with a lot of tribal entities. We do not disclose much of that information. There's a lot of confidentiality concerns. And so we do not discuss those case studies in any of our presentations. So really the small farmers portion of the program was added July 1st of 2023. So it's relatively new.
Crazy.
I just one more. First of all, I want to thank you for including women in on that description and for all gender, et cetera. And just wanted to suggest in the spirit of inclusivity and adding a word in case someone thinks it's been missed. Accessibility is also pretty big, especially with the aging of those of us who are aging. Just looking at, so that's just very big in agritourism as well. So I was just going to recommend adding accessibility to your definition.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And if you find somebody who's not aging, I mean, let's talk to them. But we're all aging.
One more quick question. Have you guys come across, working with DWR, any contaminated wells with a reasonable yield that you put a RoPro or a small RO unit in and change the complexion of the landscape?
So when it comes to, you know, yes, there are plenty of wells that are contaminated with nitrates, right? And so we're not, once you put, do RO, then you have a brine line issue. There's a disposal issue there. So we really try to right size the solutions to the community we're working with.
Dr. Gosling.
Yeah, I'd encourage you. This is a great service, but there's a lot of attention being placed on capturing of surface flow now, and so that's a segment of the water cycle that could be beneficial to co-join with this. Maybe you could have RCD and RCS capture that part of the program. Groundwater recharge would be another service that could be paired with this. Might even involve advocating for some change of state ordinance or law in order to encourage groundwater recharge. And then I encourage you to use the term or to include planned transitions of uses as well as uses within the last 10 years.
Thank you for those comments.
Yes. How much money is in your budget for helping? What's the size of it?
About 17 million.
I'm sorry.
17.
That's a lot of money. We're going to find a way to use it.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else? Not action item. Do we need to open to the public? I will. If you have anything to say, anybody online? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Thanks for the great questions.
Sorry, Dave.
Thank you. Okay, item number 8 is update on the City of Livermore general plan process and potential annexation of agricultural lands. And background, I'm going to share my screen. So this is just background because the more we know, the better. This is Livermore's general plan update. Imagine Livermore 2045, public domain document. They go through the process. Have their principles, land use concept. This is a process that is governed by the California State Constitution to be done on a cadence with special timelines for housing elements and environmental justice has their own. Got a blanket on. There's a ROSA that's in there that doesn't have a timeline and have my notes right in front of me just to look at it. And then the safety element is what's trying to get through my head. Okay, so then the City of Livermore has this map. Okay, the South Valley Area Plan is down on the south side here, big piece of our agricultural economy. Here's City of Livermore. Here's UGB and the city, or UGB is one, city boundary is another. They mostly mirror each other. There's a sphere of influence of City of Livermore that is not listed, delineated here. And these are the areas that the General Plan Update Committee of the City of Livermore came to. One is right off the freeway in North Livermore, land available. There's a specific plan downtown already. Another one was the Isabel neighborhood. And then another one, Midtown. And Midtown is a place where Valley Link, second largest JPA in the state of California, a lot of money raised. There's no guarantee it's going to happen, but that Valley Link comes through and syncs BART up with Stockton. And then you have A Strains, Union Pacific Lines, that can go down to San Jose. And this juncture here, another one out there, the places where they become close. The GPAC generally believes transportation-oriented housing is a good thing, and that's a good place for infill housing. Then there was a look and discussion of what is, quote, east of Greenville. This is Greenville Road, and here is the South Bay Aqueduct, sort of the natural, I don't call it natural, it's concrete river, right? It's a landmark piece that's right there, and that is what this surface area is. Okay, and then it was brought to this committee of, hey, that is, hey, it's Alameda County lands, it's zoned A, it's in our purview, check. Then at some juncture, Mr. Schneider came in and said, here's the soil maps report, and this should be part of the process with GPAC. I said, respectfully, Mr. Schneider, take it to GPAC. And he said, respectfully, it's agricultural lands in Alameda County, you're the Ag Advisory Committee, you should care. I said, I do, but why are we a passing mechanism? Just give it to them. And then we had some discussion, and I said, well, it doesn't matter. I'm going to give it to them anyway. It should be part of the discourse, and by all means, and they're going to get there anyway, I believe, looking at all of the data and what's there. Accurate representation so far? Okay, and then there was a discussion about how much water is available, incremental water available. Oh, there's another 5,000 acres there. LP was here. LP followed up with an email with me. That has been attached as part of our document process. Everyone had a chance to look at that one. Of just saying, okay, there's that incremental 5,000 verse. Here's what we have. Here's what's being used. And then also important in that document, which I suppose I can pull up to read. Sure, pulling up the document as it relates, the email exchange as it relates, and well, great, you have to read them backwards because that's how it works in the email world. But, you know, fundamental statement one, this only one available new turnout or the like, since there's been discussions, a turnout north, that north side of the east side to allow water to flow there. That's been an ongoing discussion since my Uncle Phil was 20 years old and he is advanced age. So it's been something that's discussed for a long time. So the question is, can incremental new turnouts happen? The answer is resoundingly yes. Seems like the rough number with the gate valve infrastructure there, not coming to sand filtration, otherwise a $2 million price tag to the private landowner, plus whatever other expenses, fees, biologists, permits, and the likes to get it done, but possible, right? Distinctly possible for a new turnout, private property covers. Statement two, additional 5,000 acre feet is available in agriculture, and that was one with I took significant exception because I don't believe that's the true case. And supported by this documentation of there are 8,100 acre feet of untreated water that Zone 7 currently has. Now, could there be more? Go out, procure new water rights and the likes. The horse trading happens ongoing. But right now, there's 8,100 and getting incremental new is difficult. And that will flow back and forth with the state water project and the like. So if we use, they say we use about 5,000 on average, so there is 3,000 there available incremental for something. Those are held by private parties right now, and so the ability to go to Zone 7 for net new is something that's is something that actually said, yeah, it's possible you can ask, you go and ask. And as I understand, the TDC is making a formal request to Zone 7. How much does the turnout cost in that 2 million range? Let's break it down more. And we'd like to make a formal request for incremental water for the purpose of Greenbelt and South Valley Area Plan. And then the TBC is deep in the Specie connected and the Greenbelt on the east side as well. So a formal request to Zone 7. Is there more water? How much does it cost? Okay, but then within that, we currently have 8,100 acre feet, but that's not just ag, right? Response to that question is, yeah, is basically 80% is ag. So 20% you take away, 8,100, take away 20%, you're now at 6,400. And it's just, you know, that's creeping down in terms of the number to then to wave a flag and say there's 5,000 available for increment. Like, gotta be careful, there's not. There could be more, you could get there and the likes. And vineyards being pulled out right now, so that could go somewhere else, darn skip. You're going to see less usage because how many people have driven down Tesla Road in the last little while? Anybody? Piles of vineyards, right? They're being pulled out, so that will result in less water use and less other things come in and are transferred in. Okay, then with that, wish I would have just said that to Mr. Schneider earlier right away. And then I've also asked Mr. Schneider, who wanted to speak in the public forum, said, hey, let's just put it in this agenda item. I've also asked him, get this to the two of us before the agenda goes out and we'll attach it in because this is just part of the EIR, the EIR associated with Measure D 2022, right? There's an EIR done on the Measure D that went to the vote of the people. This is just right out of that deck. So in my ideal world, this full EIR would be part of an attachment, not killing trees, part of the attachments. So we can all have this. So much information, so much work goes into this. And then these sections that are pertinent, we have them to the front so we can talk about what's important. He's printed up 15 copies. I've had him as so ordered to the agenda, where he could speak on this one, give us his point of view. I'm not going to cut him off at 3 minutes, but I reserve the right to cut you off as appropriate. Is that a fair statement, sir?
That's fair.
So here are your copies. You can hand them to your seat with.
The last time you asked him on. So I'll come up here so I can lock the whole grid like the close to a from my group. So last time I did speak about the soil map for the East of Greenville focus area, and you consider the dark green, the light green, and the purple. That's 80% of the land east of Greenville is either excellent, good, or fair for cultivated agriculture. The comments after I presented last time was, why are you telling us this? You should be telling the General Plan Advisory Committee that this information. So 2 weeks ago, I did. I gave them the same handout that I gave you, and I presented for my 3 minutes. And then I set it down. A couple of people I had seen, because I passed it out ahead of time, they had looked at it. Careful. Well, no action was taken at the General Plan Advisory Committee meeting last week. It was 3 hours long, 20 people from the public spoke. Then the committee started dealing with their issues. It got to be 9 o'clock. We're going to go on. No, we're going to continue the meeting until the following week, until last week. So they continued it without public comment. I didn't go back. So I don't know what their recommendation is going to be. My understanding is that it's going to be forwarded to the city, a recommendation to the planning or to the planning commission in April. But they did get this information, including a page about water that I'm giving to you, because that was a question. So this is out of the CEQA document for the Measure D 2022 amendments, the original Measure D. And the highlighted part is the relevant part about what kind of water is available. And for those who didn't get a copy or for those online, I'll just read the highlighted part on the start of the sentence above them, where your highlighting starts. The approximately 2,200 acres of existing irrigated vineyards in South Livermore therefore generates a demand for about 3,300 acre feet of water. That's assuming in the original EIR, or the 1993 ECAP, it was 1.5 acre feet of water per acre of planted vineyards. It's now closer to one. People recognize probably because it's going to more drip than sprinklers, right? Thank you. Okay, so according to the Zone 7 Urban Water Management Plan, current year, 2020, untreated water demand for irrigated agriculture was 5,810 acre feet, indicating that about 2,500 acre feet of untreated water was used elsewhere in the Zone 7 service area for irrigated agriculture. If the proposed amendments to Measure D, the project, stimulate investments in vineyard development in the South Livermore Valley, such that the full 5,000 acres of vineyards are eventually realized, the total irrigated water demands would increase to approximately 7,500 acre feet. Zone 7's Urban Water Management Plan estimated the future year 2045 demand for irrigated agriculture to be approximately 8,300 acre feet, leaving a surplus of about 800 acre feet of untreated water, raw water available for other irrigated agricultural use. So if I just stop there, if we're talking about 500 acres, 600 acres on east of Greenville at 1 acre foot per acre, there would be sufficient available untreated water based on this analysis. But I thought the last paragraph that I highlighted is very interesting, so I'll read it to you. The Zone 7 Urban Water Management Plan expects a water demand from increased irrigated agriculture that is actually less than the anticipated demand for a 55,000 acre vineyard build out in South Livermore Valley. The Urban Water Management Plan also finds that this irrigated agricultural demand, combined with a much larger demand of 43,000 acre feet for other municipal water demands of retail providers, can be met with expected future water supplies, including reduced supplies under the effects of a single dry year and a 5-year drought. So it seems to me that
instead of it being a moot point that there wouldn't be water if east of Greenville was left open land, potential agricultural land, it's not correct. It's not a moot point that there could be available water to irrigate that land so long as it remains potential farmland and is not urbanized.
By all means, is this the juncture too? You'll say that you were wrong, 5,000 incremental acre feet available, or does that not happen?
I'll admit that I just misspoke. I misinterpreted who I was getting the information from.
Thank you.
Where I got the information.
Thank you.
Okay, that's.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Schneider? I appreciate it. Any questions on that? So this is Livermore's flowing it through. It's part of their general plan process, and that's why we brought it back up. Potential action item. I'm not sure there's any action here other than standing by, but it's open to discussion. Was that you, Dick? Did you raise your hand?
No.
Someone over there did. Am I seeing things? Anything to add? Diana, anything to add of the... Did I represent the TBC appropriately of exploring what the turnouts would be and would like? So that's flowing through. Yes.
There has been in the last 4 or 5 years a new turnout. That was a career turnout. So I don't know what it costs, but I know it's there. And I think I mentioned to this group that in last year we had a wet year, and we turned out that I and others counted, you know, over 50,000 acre feet of water, and it went to the bay right down Alameda Creek. We watched it when it got up to, and when Del Valle was.
As surface water runoff was addressed in the last agenda item as well, it is an important phenomenon. I ask we stay on subject generally on this one, because a lot of it goes right to the sea, no doubt. Mr.
Yes.
Poppies.
So we can say, you know, I'm trying to do the math in my head. And what those original estimates of water uses were based on the acreage of your agriculture. You know, and if, as we've all seen, the number of acres that are actually productive is down, and it is a downward trend. So if you do the arithmetic, does that then make one additional water available for agriculture elsewhere? And what is the thought that, you know, the land up if existing land, existing infrastructure is not economically productive, what is the thought that this land up near the aqueduct, even though it might be prime farmland and water may be available, is going to be more attractive to someone wants to invest in agriculture, and the land is lying fallow right now on the south area?
My answer would be it will not be, but I don't know to whom you are addressing the question.
Okay. I think my point is that times change, things evolve, and once that land is developed, as much of the Tri-Valley has been developed, that land is gone for good. It will never be become agricultural land again.
Anybody else on this? Tracy?
Just quick, do I understand that what TBC is trying to do is basically say, let us consider the cost of getting a turnout now before waiting for later, for it to be a private entity that has to pay 2 million zillion, you know?
I believe so. Diana, please step in.
Private entity that it wouldn't be, you know, right. The county paying for it or TBC paying for it. It would be whoever is eventually going to be using the turnout. But it is just what is the proposed cost, and would it be cost prohibitive to be able to put a turnout? Kind of, you know, going to the economics of the area as it is versus the area as it could be. If we were to entertain agriculture in that area, what is needed and how much is that going to cost?
Maintain or start agriculture in the area other than rangeland, right? Yeah. Anybody else? Public, Kelly, approved.
So if you
take this idea and run with it. You amortize the capital investment of what, $2 million, and amortize it over some normal period of years. And then you add in another $200, $300 an acre foot for the cost of water, because that's the wholesale cost of water that Zone 7 is charging some of you guys, maybe more than that. Yeah, I'm using a little bit. And then you divide it out, and if you allocate, let's say, $4 million, $2 million for the capital and $2 million for the water, you might be able to get, on an annual basis, something like 1,000 acre feet for that kind of investment over the period of amortization, which 1,000 acre feet per year.
Of
which
raw
is,
water?
Of, no, the surface water.
Delivered.
Delivered. Yeah, and you know, it's not like that to change the world, but it's not like a earth-shaking amount of water. It costs a lot of money. You know, just the faucet costs a lot of money. And then secondly, on this idea of what is agricultural land or not, or whatever, the governing legal framework here is, in my mind, this thing called sphere of influence, which is controlled by LAFCO. And if you look at the sphere of influence or whatever, then you see that whoever's got that sphere of influence, and they can take whatever they want up until the sphere of influence. All they have to do is change the laws and declare it to be Livermore. Once it's Livermore does what Livermore does. And that's how things will work. So if anybody wants to protect farmland, you have to make sure that you get the sphere of influence drawn the way you want it. Because if it's not the way it is, Livermore, once they can take all the way right up to that.
And then they can adjust their, go to LAFCO petition to adjust the sphere of influence and do it again. Right. I think there's some conservationists in here that would say the only way permanent easements on it to stop, or some green belt, some barrier to stop, you know, like we can go to the extreme of the California state law. You can have one governor say UGBs are hereby disabolished, just like whatever the community benefit downtown's saying, the redevelopment agencies, right? Poof, it goes away. What if that happens and then what happens? We can have all these conjecture hypotheticals, but fundamentally, you can change all of these things by worst case vote of the people.
And that's what Benjamin D was.
Yeah. So taking you back, UGB, be changed, a vote of the people, right? Within that. And to me, this is very much in Livermore's sphere of influence, Livermore's business. And I've said that I'm very interested in this, and I care a lot about agricultural land. I also care about the processing, the amenities, the other things that go along to help an agricultural ecosystem. Some of that's needed. But you put concrete down, you're going to be hard pressed to be growing there again. It's possible, right? But it's really doubtful in the way that this world's going. So I hear all sides of it. To me, it's Livermore's business. We wrote the letter, say, hey, we want to be there, be engaged. We can only do so much on this. And that's what I know. I just, that water piece, there's potentially water available. Those are associated with parcels, with APNs, the likes down in that south side. But to get incremental new up there to make it grow, be a greenbelt, to be a cultivated, irrigated, agricultural greenbelt, Godspeed and good luck. It's a lot of dollars across that infrastructure to make it happen. Karen.
So most of the land is out there now is not owned by small farmers. There's some rural residents out there. Maybe some small farmers, but a lot of them are commercial industrialists who are planning to work with the city of Livermore to do whatever they can do to maximize their return on investment. The fact that when there was high growth with your industry, this what water was not taken advantage of, and I never really understood that. Why we kind of missed an opportunity and different pricing and so on then. And if we don't have to explain that, I'm just saying, but the comment that if irrigated agriculture was so profitable, where are the folks who want to invest in it, pay for this infrastructure and expand it wherever the pipe could go, whether it's to put grapes back in his fallow fields or go up to North Livermore where we don't think there's the soil available. So a lot of this is economics, who the landowners are now, and then what kind of optimist is our community?
Concur. Anybody else on this item? There's no action item in front of us. Obviously, it's set potential, so anybody can have the audacity to make a motion right now, should they choose to. But I don't think there's anything there. Anybody else like to say anything on this subject? And, you know,
no speakers on there.
With that, we'll close saying thank you, sir. I look forward, like we get out front, the more the merrier, because information power, right? At the end of the day, open government as a good thing. Okay, the closing eight, coming to nine, update on agricultural employee housing needs assessment. And as part of the land use subcommittee fundamentally owns the agricultural employee housing piece of this as we're moving it forward. And I have looked at Diana a few times tonight as representing the TBC, but also representing herself as a citizen here. And she will be helping to take the lead as part of the land use subcommittee as relates to the ag worker housing. Because the TBC is doing a lot of great work, let's not reinvent the wheel. The attachment that was put in here under item nine is the farm worker is a farm worker housing meeting that the TBC held, meeting with POST, which is Peninsula Open Space Trust. And what are you guys doing as it relates to ag worker housing? And then there's another document which will be shared at a future date that includes some of the other counties and some detail level work. That hasn't been shared yet, has it? The other county assessment.
I think just with the land use.
Right, and so that one I meant to get it in, but my bad, right? But at the end of the day, TBC did a lot of that outreach, and what's Monterey County doing? What's Santa Clara County doing? What's Yolo County doing as it relates to ag worker housing to build that body and that deck? So thank you very much, Diana, for saying yes to be the point of the spear, the tip of the spear on this item as it moves forward. And the floor is yours for any further update if need be right now. And I know, Sheila, you're also in this with the utilization of that 25 grand and how we're going out against that needs assessment. So I don't mean to bypass you, Sheila, but between the two of you, any updates that are worth sharing?
We are really just kind of poking around a little bit more than that, but we're trying to see what everyone else is up to, how other counties are approaching these issues, what that looks like, and then how it's affecting people on the ground in terms of actually implementing housing. So that was the main purpose of our meeting with Peninsula Open Space Trust, which has engaged in some of these projects, was how did they actually implement them? What did that look like? How much did it cost? How much did additional funding from the county help in those projects? In a lot of ways, what was expressed is without that upfront funding or the incentive of a grant, these projects wouldn't have happened. That was a lot of it. And they also talked to other landowners and said that the administrative aspect was pretty high. So without the land trust assistance, they probably would not have engaged even with the pot of money, just because going through all the permitting process, being able to do additional water sources, environmental reviews, it was just a large administrative toll. So that was another consideration that they wanted us to consider. And of course, in there, they said that their permitting process was about 2 years to be able to go from the idea phase to the completion. So that was another difficult aspect of the entire process is they would love to see some streamlining through to be able to see, you know, these projects erected in a faster timeline. But overall, they were very grateful that the program that did exist existed. And so that was kind of a grant reimbursement program up to a certain amount. The project has evolved. That amount has been increased. The amount of units that they would reimburse has increased. So it was a very interesting, informative meeting. And I think that was just one county and one entity's experience with it. So, kind of going forward, we're going to be reaching out to other counties and other entities about what works within their county and what doesn't, and kind of what recommendations we can make within Alameda County that would help move these projects along, whether that's you know, incentives or funding streams or other things.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And then jumping in, this will be shared at the next one going forward. And this is a summary again, TBC, Farmworker Housing in Northern California, summary, general resources, then programs by county, Contra Costa County, okay, what have they done? Marin County, okay, Sonoma County, some links of detail, Napa County, Solano County, Stanislaus, the like. So again, just information share. This is my miss. I thought this was the document shared, not the other one, because this is more impactful as it goes, but it's just to the good work TBC is doing. We're not looking to reinvent the wheel, but partner with collaborative parallel mission organization. So this document will be flowing out, as that's a good one there. Now, then there's that needs assessment. There was the 25 grand. And Sheila, do you have any update on that or where we are there?
No, we haven't talked with them.
Does anybody on the county staff side have an update, or what can we do to facilitate or move that along?
We don't have an update. We just need to meet with the involved parties.
And at this point, who are the involved parties?
Sheila, Allie, and Kathy.
Is it, can Diana squeeze into that one as part of this committee?
It would be very helpful. I mean, I'm curious to know what you learned from your report about what sort of needs, you know, assessments were done, at least in terms of thinking about, you know, they in the end have what, 8 units. So, you know, is that meeting a need?
Right.
And it might be helpful to know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've read a couple of them out of different communities, just to see what they've been, how they've approached it.
So with that's a yes for Diana, part of that group. Thank you for that. Thank you, Diana, for your willingness. On this item, potential action item, I don't see an action in front of us, but head around the room on this one. Ms. Dr. Gaza.
Would it be possible to get spreadsheets and timelines from the folks you dealt with?
Oh, in terms of how their project timelines work?
Yeah.
Sure, I guess.
Yeah, and spreadsheet on costs, you know, so, and whether or not they monetized the delay of project, you know, the 2 years that they futzed around if they assigned a cost.
If we modeled, I mean, part of it is there are not an enormous number of projects done. So like the first project is always going to take a longer time because it's your first project and you don't quite know everything that's involved. So, you know, kind of for their second and third project, I think that would give a better idea of, the reality of what the project would be better.
Yeah, on the other hand, sometimes those initial strategies become institutionalized. And so knowing what they were and how long they could be helpful. Also, you know, my understanding that the farm worker housing was to, the state had directed that it was to be considered an agricultural use. Mm-hmm. And as an agricultural use, it seems that there should have been a different planning process or permitting process that didn't take quite as long.
I think they would agree.
Is there a way to pursue that with the information that was provided by the Peninsula folks?
I mean, yeah, I mean, that was the biggest takeaway that I had, which was, you know, kind of forming a more specialized process to ag worker housing versus other permitting. Of course, that's a huge administrative weight, too, to set that up. So
so I saw you making a hand gesture across the room. So are there any comments regarding the agricultural use issue and how that could affect permitting?
Well, it definitely has some bearing on where agricultural housing, worker housing is allowed on a parcel. It does not have to be in 2-acre building envelope, things like that. I think there are some hurdles, and I'm just speaking off the top of my head, we don't have any experience in the department. That there was one application submitted, I think, some time ago, for one ag worker housing development. I'm not sure exactly what the status of that is, but I think there are complications having to do with septic and water and things like that that are not part of planting grapevines or
right.
that kind of thing. So I think there is, I think Diana's right, there is an inexperience factor that comes into play in terms of the time frame for getting a project approved. And then there are also some complications with providing services to make sure their health and safety concerns are addressed.
And then how about the CEQA issues? Any off the top of your head comments about how CEQA would play into it? And would CEQA review be necessary if it was an agricultural use?
Albert might have an answer. I think it might depend on the situation.
Sure.
The unique circumstances of the property. But I'm not sure.
Okay.
It could. I mean, there is the SDR requirement, so part of that could trigger CEQA. I think it really depends on the site and what the issues are.
And then if we did a programmatic study as part of our farm worker housing, would that help with the CEQA issues?
Potentially, yes.
Okay.
Programmatically, it's hard to translate to a project, like one-to-one, but it certainly would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, there's potential for it to create a checklist so that then project proponents could look at that checklist and see how it applies to their property or their project.
Yes, yeah. I do feel though that, I mean, even though that it's sort of described in our zoning code as a permitted use, it's kind of funny, it's permitted, it's actually requires an SDR.
Right.
Well, I think you've gotten presentations at past meetings about the housing element and the programs pertaining to ag worker housing are, our zoning ordinance is not up to date in terms of state law. So one of the things we will be doing to implement the housing element is update the ordinance to be consistent with state law.
Okay.
Which would mean that the permitting would be eased somewhat.
Permitted, right, really removing that SDR effectively, or like moving it up in the list of uses.
Yeah, I think that definitely would be, and that would be consistent with what we're trying to do for our housing element. But like Liz mentioned, I mean, we don't have a ton of experience. And, you know, in my 15 years working for the county, I think we've just had one person ask about farm worker housing. So it might be that, I don't know what the demand is. My sense is it's kind of small at this point because of that. I don't think it's zero, but.
I don't either, but so now, and I don't think it's, like, it'll be tough without the infrastructure needed, right? So, but if you have potable water and you have a septic and a hypothetical thing, what could you do with that? So now it's about entitlements. For doesn't have to have a 2 acre to it because it is agricultural related, agricultural purposes. So we don't have a building envelope thing. Now we have an FAR thing and egress out, in, out, fire safety. There's a lot more to it, but how does it fit within the FAR? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have to look at all that. I mean, there are some limits in the code right now to a certain number of units. So it would have to fall into that unless we were to change it. Yeah, I mean, I think we'd have to explore that.
But yeah. And so just on the hypothetical, I think that unit says 40-something, 50-something, which is no small number. How does that fit against that FAR? Because all of a sudden, like, I think, you know, imagine if someone did that right there, build a 50-unit thing. I feel like people would go gonzo again to use that language. But if it's permitted by right, what happens when the rubber meets the road?
Yeah.
So I'm asking hypotheticals, I get, but I think, right, there's, so I'll shush. Yes, sir.
I was just going to comment a little bit on the FAR on it, and also the 2 acre building envelope. Is it outside the 2 acre building envelope allowed? And why can't we give it the same priority in the county as we do ADUs? ADUs, you have to turn them over relatively quick, at least in the urban area. And matter of fact, I think it's 30 days on it, is an hour we have to approve.
In some cases, 60.
Okay.
But generally, yeah. It's, so, I mean, yeah, there is no planning permit for an ADU.
And if we could look at that, I think the real hiccup getting through and urban and rural properties will be your septic.
As stated, right, the hypothetical, like of if there were a sewer or then it's there's different treatment, there's different, but getting that septic through would be a tough thing. That's why Liz said infrastructure, how realistic is it? And I get it, but at the same time, like what's the art of possibility if because of those, it's the O2, the incremental 0.025 FAR was there's a whole residential, non-residential component to it, right? Now you're saying it's an ag building, but it's residential, non-residential, but if you're having farm workers, you're making them residential, right? It's just sort of this circular thing, and like the heart of what if, of what can somebody do with that parcel of land if. And so that's the essence and the drive. There hasn't been a lot. The needs assessment, there's a certain need there. It's not a huge need. That's there, no doubt, but there are, like, having agricultural labor is an incremental step in the ecosystem, a successful economic ecosystem. And so that's why they're important. I think to your point of the state laws, where the timeline on it coming down, right, you have to do it by this much or this, because we got it, as I understand, y'all know way more than me, but like got it into the housing element. There's something in the housing element as relates to ag worker housing as part of a special needs housing piece, that there will be a follow along, I believe, where they can, you know, you're going to have to process it in due time because it's part of the special needs housing as governed by state law. So your request, I believe, will happen only if there's a permit that comes across the desk, because if not, there's no there. We're just talking about it.
Right. I think that the challenge when you look at the whole deal is going to be septic and wells. And when you look at the cost of the septic system today for four-bedroom type deal for multiple families or something like that, I mean, about $60,000 to $100,000.
It's been stipulated the infrastructure, potable water, human waste is going to be an impact.
Which is why you only have one.
So we had a de facto action of adding Diana to that committee moving forward on the 25. That doesn't need a vote, as far as I'm concerned. Any other comments, questions on this item?
Thank you.
From the public, Mr. Schneider.
So everybody's been talking about farm workers. I would suspect that many farm workers are part of farm worker families. And if they're going to be families, where are the families going to live? Are they going to live just where the farm workers live? Where are the children going to go to school? Are they going to be segregated because they're all going to be in a collective and it's going to be remote? Are they going to be integrated into society where there's going to be friends? So I think there's a lot of social issues to consider when you're thinking about farm worker housing, not just where the farm workers themselves live. That needs to be factored in.
Yeah, so darn skippy. And there are, some of it has like the single use, this versus family homes and the likes there. So it's all the good and right questions. And do you have anything to add, Mr. Doctor?
Yeah, I think what we're doing is creating a problem list. And, you know, what hopefully will be coming forward is a solutions list, because the issue of sanitation, environmental health is in the foreground rather than in a sidebar conversation long ago by saying that compost toilets work. And, you know, there's just a need for an ordinance that approves that. That ordinance exists. It exists in Humboldt County. It exists across the Bay in the county of San Francisco. So we can cut and paste that. Water, we've already determined that water can be delivered by truck for agricultural uses. So we have a solution to that problem. The issue of socialization or families, just addressing the workers that would like to have a place to sleep at night as they do their 5-day-a-week job in this area, but then go home for the weekend or another 2 or 3 days off. That is an option that farm workers will advocate for. You know, give us a place to live over there where we do our work. We'll come home for a couple of days. So, you know, the questions are good, but the fact that we have so many people living in shacks and in cars demonstrate that there's a pretty diverse need. And finding specific solutions for some of those specific reasons why people are living in cars and shacks is probably something we can do.
Thank you. There was a hand over here. Was it you, Mr. Chow? You have anything to say?
No, I was just going to say that these get pretty important. I as Dave mentioned, schools, I know that many of the ranches in my area, they do have some farm worker housing on there, like an ADU type deal, and the kids are going to local schools. We had a real issue at the fairgrounds a couple of years back when we lost the horse racing, and we had to really help a lot of families find places to go and find schools for their kids to get into. That is going to come back around to us here shortly because Golden Gate Fields closed. Golden Gate Fields closed. We applied for the race dates for the entire Northern California last week, and the CHRB gave them to us. So Pleasanton now will become the home of horse racing for Northern California, and we'll be housing 900 horses there now. We're putting in another 150 stalls.
Coming back to item number nine, tying it to.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, their housing is going to become a real issue because.
It's going to become.
I mean, reality is that there's people that work in the stalls and clean them and taking care of them, walking the horses.
Ag workers.
You know, they're going to have somewhere to go. And
we as a committee have nodded our heads that, like, anecdotally, again, thank God we trust everyone's common data. This isn't data based, but we have farmers in here speak to it like that there is a need. Now, and what does it look like? How do you get it done? All of that. Yeah. And it's going to get, hopefully, if we continue to grow our ag ecosystem, there's going to be more. And we do stuff like that, there's going to be more. So anything else on this item? Public, close. Are you anything else from your side? It said planning staff, and I just took right over on that one. You good on that? Closing that item? Okay, closing item eight. We're going to open item nine real quick. This is going to be a brief one. I'm not going to, it says action item because I don't
What do you mean 10?
Share the screen. So National Ag Day has come again, and it's gone. March 19th. Bye. We had previously multiple times, right, since I've been here, talk about, hey, maybe we should get out front and do something. We're the Ag Advisory Committee of this county, and Ag Day comes and goes. And we don't do anything about it. I'd like at this juncture to close item number 10 for a future discussion. But yes, Diana.
So Livermore High School still does Ag Day, which is in April.
April.
The day of our next meeting, 23rd. Have we ever done anything with Livermore High for their Ag Day?
No, we didn't do it with Livermore High, but in on the east of the West County, couple of supervisors put together a deal around Ranch Rodeo where we brought kids in. It was an Ag Day and it was being developed, but the funding kind of dried up on busing. So it's a big deal. It would be something that we should get behind.
Concur.
Livermore's got FFA chapter. Lisa used to.
Oh, they still do. Yeah. So there's
we have a representative. We have our FFA member here.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about Lee? We've got some kind of
We're the last FFA chapter in the county, and we only have about three or four 4-H chapters at this point. And so, yes, it would be really good for the Ag Advisory Committee to come to our Ag Day to talk to some of the third graders and show them a bit about the politics that occur behind it, because we all know they love to see the animals. We have kids hauling, I haul in my sheep. We have steers, cattle, we have horses, we have a mini horse, a donkey that comes in. But to have the kids actually see some of the more heavy lifting of the background might be very good, because I don't think even most of our chapter knows that I do this and that this committee exists. So it would be a really good outreach opportunity.
Kathy.
And every year the agriculture department, along with the Farm Bureau, participates or coordinates a Ag Day with the Board of Supervisors. Usually at the end of March, in fact, it was going to be today. We rescheduled it because the agenda with the board was huge today. So we rescheduled it. We're actually going to do Ag Day on April 16th. FFA is going to be joining us. Farm Bureau is going to be there. And then versus looking at the bigger agriculture producers, we've tried to find smaller producers or people involved in agriculture from each of the supervisors' districts. So, you know, what's going on in District 5 in agriculture, and how can we highlight that for that supervisor? What's going on in District 3 for that supervisor, and how can we highlight that there is agriculture going on in Alameda County? And it's not necessarily the big vineyards or the big, but there is a smaller agriculture that's happening. So
where?
Pardon?
Where is that? You said there.
This is in front of the Board of Supervisors. And the
in chamber, in session, so to speak.
Yeah, during the regular board meeting. We also collect locally grown or agricultural products. So if anyone wants to provide some products for the bags for April 16th, let me know. It's a hard time of year to get good agricultural products to put in our local Alameda County agriculture bag. But so that's something we've done every year for.
With wine cow?
Sure.
How many bags? Yeah.
So we do 6 bags for each of the supervisors, and then our KDM. So we put 6 bags together for the supervisors, and talk with Joe's going to be there, and I'm not sure who Joe Feely, the FFA advisor from Livermore High. Farm Bureau's going to be there, like I said.
So to me, it is a natural phenomenon that the AAC would be there too, and a show of support all the way through.
You're definitely invited. As far as getting up and being a speaker or being involved in the presentation, as it is, it's going to be a hopefully 45-minute presentation, wow, and not an hour presentation. So we're trying to keep it as short as possible. You know, their supervisors are hectic, but by the time I get one or two groups, and I'm trying to limit it to one group for each district, and I tell people, you have 2 minutes? Well, they can talk for 2 minutes.
We can put a timer up there and pause on.
But, you know, and the supervisors have loved, we've had 4-H there. We've had Acton Non-Verba has been there in the past. I think they're going to be there again this year with a bunch of smaller kids in their gardens and getting people excited about agriculture. You get the FFA there, and usually we have 2 or 3 members. You've been there before, right? Miranda, 3 or 4?
I might have been.
I think so. But, you know, they all get up and they're in their little outfit or their jacket, their pretty jacket, and they really do steal the show, especially when we can get kids there. So with COVID, it's kind of died down, so this will be the first one. Last year we just did a video with some of Dan Marcial and, you know, some of the local growers in the area. So this will be our first year since COVID back in person with the supervisors. But it gets to be quite a lengthy presentation just by trying to represent all of Alameda County versus just our main agricultural area.
And the date is which?
It's going to be April 16th.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, everyone's invited. If you would like to come to the court chamber that day.
Absolutely good in the baskets.
Caps.
Yeah.
So this is just, I put this one on because of how we show up, that outreach celebration, National Ag Day, celebrating this one. I think we should. We don't need to make it any longer than the likes. That said, right, if in an ideal world, Karen would be there, she would get 2 minutes, and she'd say, hey, as representative of the Ag Advisory Committee, we are here, we support, we appreciate Ag, here's what we do, bye. Because it helps to make us part of the culture, and if it's National Ag Day, and like give us a chance to show and be there, but we don't need more to do than otherwise too, and I just volunteered Karen without even asking. And anybody else we find, but not looking for taking away from the kids, taking away from the stuff, but just showing up, and that's part of what we want to do, like, maybe, you know, so I'll leave it. Anything else? Anybody else on this item? Karen?
So my message is in letters to the editor and on my Facebook page and so on for Ag, not only Ag Day, is I have a sign on the gate that says,
it's Ag Day every day at the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Ag Day every day in Alameda County. And I don't know if there's somewhere down there where we kind of think about kind of just phasing those things
in the parlance, so
around the county.
That's
kind of one half an hour for each area, for example, and do it five times instead of trying to put them together, for example.
Man.
What is the date in 2025? I'm on the website. I can't find it.
The National Ag Day? It's actually usually around the third week of March.
Yeah, so last week.
Yeah. John, I'm taking advantage of sharing something, because at the fairgrounds, we created a foundation for our farm. And we're going to actually start to break ground here shortly on it. Our target was to raise $6 million. We raised $1.5 million. Safeway donated $750,000, which has really motivated us to get this thing going. And it's, as you come to the panel back in the back, that whole acreage is going to be a farm. And it's going to be a farm year-round for bringing kids from the schools in there. Southern California did it. I went down and looked at it. It's amazing. We'll have milking cows. We'll have everything there. It's going to be a really neat deal. So if you have an opportunity and you come out to the fair this year, kind of check out the area. We have a foundation. Pick up some information on it, because we'd love to have help, particularly in raising money, because it's going to be an expensive venture. But the fair will have complete farm. So it's going to be huge deals.
Sorry, on top of Livermore's Ag Day that they've done every year, Eden Area Ag Day at the Royal Ranch was going on for several years, and then really COVID put the kibosh on that. There's a West Oakland Ag Farm in off of Mandela near the post office of 7th or up in that area, and they have an Ag Day, or have up until COVID, so I'm hoping they'll resurrect that, and they have a farm built there that's cooking farm. They've got chickens, planter boxes for people need to grow things. So I'm hoping that there's funding and there's interest in getting that back up to where it could be before it got decimated by COVID. So there are efforts throughout them.
Thank you, Kathy, for doing it.
Indeed. Tracy.
Well, I recommend in 2025, and I was thinking about you right away, ma'am, and your entire program there, but when I hear about all these different ag days, my brain immediately goes to, why don't we put them all together in a particular week or type, just like manufacturing day that occurs in the county and then participate at other, without necessarily creating our own event. But then we can have that presence. So I definitely think that's a good idea.
Yeah. Agreed.
We'll work on this. We'll work on it together.
Any other comments on item 10? Closing item 10, going to item 11. And for any of the subcommittee chairs, making sure that you're a squeaky wheel in terms of moving things up on the agenda, where it's critical that we talk about this today. And so I can move it forward, as opposed to there's a lot of standing stuff there that we keep it there. But I appreciate the work being done by those committees that are convening. And, not particularly Mr. Quigley, but thank you, Mr. Quigley, for just continuing to convene, bringing people in, trying to bring electeds in and the likes, and have a vision for what we want to do and moving it forward. So just singling you out and saying thank you.
Yes.
Karen, as always, your tireless work and effort here is mission critical and important. I want to give you the floor, Karen, real quick. Are there any of those items that are that you would like a vote or to discuss?
Yes, and I've been AWOL a couple of months, but I have not heard if Lynn Hunsinger's appointment was officially approved by the Board of Supervisors. So we still have a vacancy in Records of Parks. We're looking to recruit for it, so help us do that. And on the agenda, and I'll be working with you too, as we had questions on how to update the roster to make it fresh and current. And so on the agenda tonight is consideration for three openings. These are three positions that have
termed out their first term already, but these three individuals have interest in being reappointed, and that's Larry Goslin, Chuck Campos, and Clayton Coatman, who is not here. And if, the last time we did this, that we handled them as separate motions. So with that, I'll open the discussion with a conversation motion to recommend Larry to continue on the advisory committee with a second appointment.
Motion by Karen, second by whom? By Ms. Campos. All in favor by raising your hand, saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? I need to have a discussion on the motion beforehand. Does anybody want to discuss that?
Larry, you still want it, huh?
Yeah.
Closed. The vote still counts. Anybody opposed? Speak now. Record shows passes unanimously with any appropriate abstentions. I guess we would need it. Okay, next.
And then I'd recommend Chuck Campos to continue in his position of crops. You've got your tractor all out dieseled up and ready to go, right?
And it's right there in the field.
All right, motion.
Yes, that was a motion.
Second by Ms. Quigley. Discussion. So it's thrown out, right? It's there a certain amount of the demonstrated expertise in field, rather have butts and seats. But if we have these positions, like to say, do you really farm the best? You do this as we go. So like because Lord knows, and I'm putting you on the spot, Chuck, because I love you, right? We have a certain amount of farmers in this room, dirty boots that are growing things. In as part of what we're doing. And so I think, are we holding ourselves accountable to the demonstrated expertise in the field as we go? I don't want to change. I vote yes. I second the motion, right? I'm not getting into it right now, but demonstrated expertise in the field for the purpose, powers, and duties of the statute as we go forward. Let's just keep that one in mind. I have a motion and a second on the table for discussion. All in the public comment.
Real comment, but and since it's Mr. Campos, I'm sure he won't be upset with this comment. I think that these seats, not just equity, whatever, but is the seat full most of the time? And Mr. Campos to pull most of the time. So
more bodies is a good thing.
Yeah, and if the seat's empty most of the time, you got to ask yourself, why are we keeping an empty seat?
Thank you, Dan Skippy, and we'll continue to. And are we violating statute by not showing the expertise? They shall have, right? It's one of those things where I'm not going to go there now, but it's just part of the dance of one. Just have the right discussions.
There's one thing I want to point out, though. We can make recommendations, but this is a board of supervisors.
Correct.
Piece. So we can say, yeah, do it, not do it. But whatever the relationship is, that particular person or has with that board member that appoints them, they appoint them and are voted on by the entire board. So if it's a four-year term, they serve 4 years, and then they have to be reappointed again. So just keep in mind that we can make a recommendation, but it could fall on deaf ears.
On everything that we do, fundamentally, that's the case. But there's been a pattern that they're taking the recommendations of the people that we put through. So there's motion and second on the table. All in favor, Mr. Campos, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Speak now. Passes unanimously. Record reflects. Clayton, how about it?
So I forgot to mention that Larry's position is wildlife. Just so you know, he must have some critters running around his place.
I actually have a fair amount of experience.
Yeah, the third position is Clayton Coatman, if I remember right. I don't have the roster. He is watershed is his category as a professional. And so I'll open the discussion with a motion to recommend Clayton's renewal.
He hasn't shown up. I can't support it in good faith. I tell him to his face. No one else is still in the seat. But at the same time, I would recommend we don't make that motion and pass it through unless you had to know something different. Have you spoken with him?
Oh, yeah. He's interested in supporting ag members in this committee, people who are in ag production.
Then let's do it. I'll move Clayton Coatman. I'll leave my own lawyers just to have it go because it's warm seat. He shows up sometimes. We have good conversations. He cares about ag. Motion on the table.
Has anybody talked to Clayton?
She said she has. I'm seeing him tomorrow. I'll let you know.
I'll see you too.
Talk to him.
Motion on the table.
I talked to him a few years ago.
Someone.
Is there it required a second?
That's my phone.
Yeah, got it.
There is no second to this one.
Can you repeat that motion?
Move to appoint Mr. Koopman for another term.
Yeah, it was to recommend his renewal of a new term.
I would recommend. I would second that until he resigns.
Now we have a motion to second. All in favor, say aye. Vote does not pass. Clayton. I'll make sure I want to tell Clayton that I did vote for him. anything else, Karen?
Well, yeah, that raises an interesting question. So then we need a recruitment for a watershed manager should he not be reappointed by the Board of Supervisors without our recommendation. I mean, I don't know if they'll
won't take it to the Board of Supervisors saying you recommend this if we didn't, so. But I don't know.
It's a vacancy, although he is entitled to serve until replaced, as our bylaws say, if he comes.
Understood. Anything else, Karen?
That's it.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that Lynn Hunsinger's consideration for appointment will be on the 4-2, April 2nd.
4-2, thank you.
Board meeting.
Thank you very much. 4-2, Lynn.
Liz?
No, I was just...
Same thing.
Pointing out.
Good, Karen?
Thank you. That's good.
Okay, anything?
Bill? It's been reported with an interest of time all at this end, so.
Perfect. Anybody else? E3, anything? Move to adjourn. So close. Thank you all so much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.